Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. There's more to sustaining forest ecosystems than meets the eye. And according to Dr. Jim Files, the new scientific director of the Sustainable Forest Management Network, communication between disciplines is critical. Cougar sightings are up in Alberta, and some grizzly bears prefer hanging around logging roads rather than running away. Carrie Raver and Kyle Knopf are two students looking for the reasons why these things are happening, and they're doing so with the help of the Alberta Conservation Association. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. If there's one thing people have learned about forest management over the last decade, it's that everything is much more complicated than we'd like. But complexity doesn't mean it's impossible to manage forests in a sustainable manner. What's important is that we develop a mindset that embraces complexity. That's the perspective Dr. Jim Files hopes to instill in the people he's working with at the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Jim is a professor of ecosystem ecology at McGill University, and he's the new scientific director with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Jim was in Edmonton recently to meet with his fellow researchers.
From my perspective, the big challenge and the big question has to do with the number of factors, and those factors might include biophysical factors, soils, vegetation, climate, those kinds of things, but also bringing into the mix of different sectors, the forest sector, who's got responsibility for forest management, the way that forest management is carried out under a administrative or a legislative regime that determines what happens on the ground, and all the social groups that interact in that. It makes a very complex system, and that the actual result of that arises from the interactions between the relationships between those various pieces. And I think that just dealing with that complexity is what the fundamental question for Canadian sustainable forest management is.
But how do you bring that down to a level where you have all this complexity? How can people understand it and then do something useful from it?
That's actually the big issue, and we're still looking for ways to deal with that. The standard way to deal with complexity is to ignore it. And so we have people that are disciplinary people that say, okay, well, I'm going to work on, you know, the plant aspect or the birds, or I'm going to work on the, you know, silviculture technique or whatever, or I'm going to be an academic researcher, or I'm going to be a government researcher, or I'm going to be an industry person. And we work within our own disciplinary background and our own cultures, which in some respects is why we're in the difficult state that we are, because the nature of the system demands that we look across those boundaries. We work across those boundaries. We learn the language of the people that are on the other side of the boundary so that we can communicate. But we don't have really good techniques for embracing the complexity. That's one of the things that drew me to the network to begin with, is because in a sense it's an experiment in being able to get all those people around the same table to share in the development of a vision for sustainable forest management and what then that means for research and for policy and practice in Canadian forestry.
You are the new scientific research leader at the Sustainable Forest Management Network. You're taking over where Vic Adamovich has left off. How do you see that you are going to take that work and carry on and deal with all these complex communication issues?
I think one of the qualifications I have for the job was that I was very closely involved in the development of the School of Environment at McGill University. And that was an initiative of three different faculties, an applied science faculty, my faculty, the science faculty, which is sort of pure science, and the arts faculty. And in doing that, I mean, obviously the environment, there is no environmental problem, similarly to there's no forest problem, that can be approached purely from a single disciplinary point of view. So that the environment is interdisciplinary by definition. And so in developing that, we started to get experience of, for me, just learning that those cultures in the other faculties were completely different from my culture in my own academic upbringing, so to speak, and that we could spend a lot of time sitting around a table talking and using the same words in the same language and realize 2 hours later that we hadn't been communicating at all because those different words are used differently or understood differently in different cultures. And we were, I think, quite successful in working past huge amount of frustrations and bridging those boundaries, and that experience actually made me wonder whether I could sort of myself grow into a more complex issue, which is the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is national. So you've got this federal level, you've got provincial level jurisdictions, you've got Aboriginal groups, you've got non-governmental organizations, you've got different industry sectors, small companies, big companies, companies that are regional, companies that are national and international. It's a very interesting group to work with, and it's been a challenge, but I'm continually impressed by the quality of the people that are around the table and the quality of the discussion that goes on. It's really very remarkable.
Well, you're out here from McGill, and you've packed an awful lot into your visit here this time. And one of the things that you are looking at right now is making the final decisions on what research projects are going to go ahead in over the next year. What are some of the areas where there still are some gaps that you're trying to fill in terms of our knowledge about how the forest works and how we can integrate our science into the industrial practices?
Well, a couple of issues that are kind of burning issues at the moment are, in one case, how to manage and how to deal with riparian areas. These are the transition zones between the upland terrestrial or forest lands and the aquatic systems. So, and you can picture those as being transitions through shrubs and herbs through into reeds and sedges and things and out into the water. But they vary quite a lot across the country. And they're a particular management problem because we know that they're very sensitive to management. We have lots of regulations that are associated with those. Some cases, the forest industry can do things in them. Sometimes they can't. There's different buffer strip widths that are important. But there's just a whole lot of questions about how those ecosystems, unique ecosystems, work and how they respond to management and what can happen on the terrestrial side that will then impinge on how those riparian systems work and then how that's translated into changes in the aquatic systems. So there's a level of complexity in those systems that's very interesting, and we know a lot about those, but there are still many, many questions, particularly in the implementation point of view. What do we understand about the ecology of those systems, and what does that mean to how we should manage them? The other issue seems to be sort of trivial, but it's one of these things that also is well understood, which is the processes of succession. If you have a disturbance, whether it's a fire or whether it's a harvesting situation, the forest will respond, new species will come in, the seedlings will start, and they'll grow and they'll mature. The whole concept of forestry is kind of based on understanding how trees grow and how that sort of process works. But there's a whole lot of other values that are associated with it. How do habitats change over that period of time? How does coarse woody debris, for instance, a very important habitat for some species, change over that time? How does small differences at the beginning lead to maybe big changes in or big differences in the composition of the forest over time? That if you harvested a site like this or you treated it like that, you might on one hand end up with a pure aspen stand versus a pure white spruce stand, and what's the significance of that to forest management? How does that get interpreted in terms of wood supply, habitat management models, other values of the forest, and in fact things like the quality of the water that are coming out of those watersheds, those kinds of things. So those are just two kind of examples. We have about 10 other things that we were looking for in terms of research priorities.
You're also giving a talk today, and the title of your talk is Sustainable Forest Management in Canada, What Are We Sustaining? I hope that's not a rhetorical question.
It's a bit of a story behind that, because, I mean, what does the program director of the Sustainable Forest Management Network talk about. He should talk about something to do with sustainable forest management. The network has had a run at defining what sustainable forest management is many times. And when we bring the subject up, it's not uncommon for people to say, oh, yeah, we've already talked about this. But our understanding is changing, our understanding of the system, and our understanding of the question, in fact, about what we're sustaining is changing. We've got some very good criteria and indicators process that's been developed by the Canadian Council of Forest Ministers over several years. A recent revision has been submitted, but which keys in on six criteria that we should look at when we're thinking about sustaining forests, and within those, a whole series of indicators. But there's a tendency to take that as kind of a checklist you can check off, and we could, you know, we're doing this, but we're not doing that. And we hear that from various partners, forest industry or governments or whatever, that we can't define what sustainable forest management is because it means something different to everybody. And I personally feel that there are some sort of fundamental thoughts about what we should be sustaining that we need to keep in mind. And one of the things is that it's not a list, that in fact we can list things because it's convenient to do that, but in fact we have to think about all those as being intertwined. So can we choose this one and this one? I don't think so, because this one and this one are linked to those other two over there, and if we don't sustain those two, we're not going to be able to sustain the first ones. This is a system that we're working with, a whole series of relationships that we have to think about. So that's one of the points that I want to make. And the other point is the difficulties that are associated with coming to grips with the fact that the forest is changing, and it will change. We've got climate change, we've got invasive species that are coming in, we've got growing populations either in the forest, around the forest, and demanding forest products. Things are changing, and that makes our projections, our thinking about what we can sustain, very challenging, because we can't see what the future is. The future is going to be different than the past. If the future was going to be the same as the past, we could say, this is the way it's going to be. If we do so-and-so, this is the way it's going to work out. But it's a very, very challenging issue. And so in the end, what are we sustaining? What should we be sustaining? Well, some of the things we should be sustaining are the capacity for the human society to innovate, to understand complex problems, to deal with those kinds of changes, to come up with ideas. And so that's very much outside the forest, but our sustainability of the forest is going to be really dependent upon coming up with good policies that prescribe good practices that are based on a very good understanding of how forest ecosystems work. And so together we need to sustain all those things. We could have a perfect understanding of how the forest worked, but if we had poor understanding of how policy worked, we could never sustain the forest. And the opposite is true. We could have brilliant policies, but if we didn't understand how the forest worked, we wouldn't have sustainable forest management. So in a sense, it's a package deal. You have to have it all, and we need to think about it in that way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Jim Files. He holds the Tomlinson Chair in Forest Ecology at McGill University, and he's the new Scientific Director for the Sustainable Forest Management Network, which is centered at the University of Alberta. As part of its commitment to scientific research, the Alberta Conservation Association sponsors a chair in fisheries and wildlife at the University of Alberta. The position is held by biologist Dr. Mark Boyce, and it's his responsibility to guide graduate students through their own research on wildlife and conservation issues. Among the young scientists working out of the Boyce Lab, as they call it, are Kyle Knopf and Carrie Raver. Carrie's interest is grizzly bears. Kyle is working towards a PhD on cougar predation. Cougars are solitary animals, living predominantly in the western foothills and mountains, but increased sightings suggest their range is expanding, and they're very efficient predators.
They eat a little bit of everything with hooves. They'll take sheep and elk and deer. And they also eat some smaller things, rabbits, lagomorphs, things like that.
You're going to be doing a research project on cougars. What exactly are you looking for?
My research will focus on cougar predation in the central east slopes up near Rocky Mountain House. What I'm focusing on specifically is what factors affect what a cougar eats. How does it choose prey?
What's the concern with cougars?
Well, one of the big concerns is that cougar populations seem to be expanding throughout the West. They're a very difficult mammal to census, precisely for the reasons we've just talked about earlier. They're very hard to see, and it's not easy to get a good handle on how many there are. However, sightings and predation on livestock and also hunting quotas have been increasing throughout the West. And it appears that there are more cougars out there, and this may have large impacts on populations of prey, and it's a pretty important thing to get a better handle on how that works.
How are you going to set up your study?
What I plan to do is to capture several cougars out on the Central East Slopes and fit them with GPS collars so that we can follow their movements and determine the types of habitat that they select, and also follow them to kill sites and see what they're eating and try to sort of pick apart which factors affect how they choose those particular prey items.
If you're going to be looking for what it is they've been eating, would there actually even be anything left for you to look at?
Yeah, certainly. We plan to use some pretty fancy GPS collars that are uploadable via satellite link. What we hope to do then is to go out to clusters of GPS points, so location clusters, which often indicate that there's been a kill made there. And then what we'll look for is things like bones and hair, which will help us identify the species that was killed. And also sometimes age and sex will be available.
Well, if there's a cluster, does that mean that, say, one cougar would kill something, but others would come in and they'd all feast?
Well, cougars are actually a solitary animal, so with the exception of mothers with kittens, you'd only expect that one cougar would be on that kill. However, other carnivores, including different cougars, could come into a kill and usurp it from the cougar who made that kill.
Once you get your cougars collared and you see what they're eating, how are you going to use all of that information? What are you going to draw from it?
Well, what we hope to use that information for is to predict what species and where and when cougars will make their kills. This is particularly important for the various species of prey consumed by cougars. Some small populations of ungulate prey can be at high risk if there's a lot of cougar predation. For example, sheep in particular, and also potentially endangered woodland caribou populations can suffer greatly from cougar predation. So what we hope to do is to be able to better predict when those populations will be at risk from cougar predation. So we want to know what factors are associated with predation events on specific ungulates. Essentially, when do kill rates for a particular ungulate species go up for a cougar?
There's an awful lot of work that's going on out in that area, not just with cougars, but also elk and wolves and various other animals. How does all of this interrelate?
Well, it's pretty important in an area like that to get a really good understanding of all the components of the ecosystem. For example, elk in that area are at below target levels, and there's a lot of wolf research going on in that area to determine the effects of wolf predation, also in order to get a better idea of how many wolves are out there and things like that. It would also be very beneficial to have a good idea of how cougars fit into all of this. So essentially, the more species that we have a good handle on out there, the better we'll understand the whole ecosystem and the better we'll understand how to manage that system.
When do you expect to get out there and put those GPS collars on?
Well, probably not till next winter. It takes a pretty concentrated effort, lots of people involved. Also, it takes snow on the ground, because the way you put the GPS collars on a cougar is to track them with hounds, typically after it's snowed. So we'll be waiting till next winter to do that. We have to raise a substantial amount of money in order to do this as well. And so that's where our focus will be over the coming months.
So you track them on foot, not with helicopters?
Yeah, no, we don't capture cougars with helicopters. Often that would be very difficult because they're hard to find, partly because they don't use those open spaces we talked about. So the way you do it is to track them with dogs, and a cougar's response to a dog is to go up a tree. And once they're in the tree, you can immobilize them and effectively collar them, essentially.
Are these hounds that are actually in Alberta, or do you have to bring them in?
No, these are hounds that are actually in Alberta. We have cougars are a hunted species in Alberta, and this is the method that they use to hunt them as well. So there are several outfitters in the province who own dogs which are specially trained for this sort of thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Kyle Knopf, a PhD student in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. Another student working in the lab of Dr. Mark Boyce is Carrie Raver. For her master's thesis, Carrie is continuing some long-term research on grizzly bears. Her particular interest is why grizzlies are attracted to roads in the forests of the eastern slopes.
Previous research has found that in the foothills of west central Alberta, that they aren't avoiding roads, which is what is usually the case in most other areas throughout North America and Canada. But in this particular area, they're actually hanging out a lot around roadways, and I'm trying to figure out why.
Any indications?
Well, I've just sort of started, but I believe that it's because there's a food source around roadways that's attracting them there. So I'm trying to figure out if the food source existed before the road was there, or if they're later attracted to the road because of ditch side vegetation and the clearing and the canopy that's created by a road.
What kinds of things do grizzly bears eat?
They eat a wide variety of stuff. They actively hunt. A few of them, large males, will actively hunt ungulates, deer and such. They also eat a lot of plants and berries and roots, and they dig for ants as well.
What is it, then, that would be around roads in terms of vegetation that would attract the bears?
Well, in the ditches in particular, there's dandelions, and they plant clover in the ditches, so they really like that kind of stuff. And also, after a road goes in, there's usually a cut block or clear cut at the end of that, and that opens up the canopy cover and also has a lot of bear foods down there.
What does it mean for bears to be hanging around roads? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's quite a bad thing, which is sort of the problem that we're looking at. They're attracted to roads because of the good food source, but there's also a really high risk of mortality because of people just being hit by cars, or there's a lot of poaching and even legal hunting. And there's also people who encounter a bear might think that it's a danger and will end up, you know, shooting it for their own protection.
Is this mainly just in forest logging areas?
Well, these problems occur everywhere, but the association with bears and roads has only been seen in these logging areas, the foothills, where it's not too steep. There's a lot of industry going on. In the mountains in Jasper area, it's not as much of a problem because bears can move to other habitats because there aren't as many roads through the area.
For your study, how is it that you're actually going to do the research?
Well, this is a long-term study. It's been going on for, well, since 1999. So we have a lot of past data, and so I know where new roads developed. So I'm going to look at these ravines in particular, where a new road has went in, and I'm going to see how the bear is moving before the road goes in, if it's actually attracted to that area, or if later after the road comes in is when it starts coming to that area.
Why is it unusual for bears to be hanging around roads? You say that this comes from previous research.
Yeah. Most of the research has been done in the U.S., but also a little in Canada and some in Europe. But they basically avoid roads just because humans, they know that there's a risk of mortality there. So when there are no alternative food sources available, they are forced to come closer to roads. In Yellowstone in particular, they found that there was a certain kind of nut. And whenever that crop was bad, bears were often found around roadways more. But when it was really abundant that year, then they rarely ever saw bears around roads.
So what about the bears and their food source in Alberta compared to what they found in the state?
Well, our study area in particular has two portions. Part of it is in Jasper National Park, and the other part is in this managed forest where there's a lot of logging going on. In Jasper, they have found that bears have had higher levels of stress hormones, which means that they're not able to find as much food. And they also have lower levels of reproductive hormones, so they produce at a much older age. But in the FMF, in the managed part, the canopy cover is cleared because of the logging, so there's a lot more food available. So they have less stress, and they reproduce at a much earlier age. But when you compare those two areas, bears within Jasper live much longer because there's less mortality. In the Foothills Model Forest, they haven't captured any females over 10 years old, which indicates that they're dying much earlier because of all this human access.
What ultimately will you be doing with this research? Will this go into developing new management plans for bears and roads?
Hopefully it will. I am hoping that they will be able to look at riparian areas that are very important to bears and possibly not develop a road in that area or in areas that we know are the bears are using heavily and there's already a road there, that maybe that road can be closed or removed to prevent a lot of these mortality cases.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
That was Carrie Raver, a master's student in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. I also spoke with Kyle Knopf. Both students are supervised by Dr. Mark Boyce, who holds the Alberta Conservation Association Research Chair in Fisheries and Wildlife. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts at our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.